This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, mathematician Eugenia Cheng takes us to infinity and beyond. That'll be kind of interesting. I think you'll like it. But first, last year, California's Death Valley was struck by a super bloom of spring wildflowers. Well, this spring, it's Anza Borrego State Park that's all a bloom in California. Sunflowers, yellow desert dandelions, brittle bush have painted the park in sprays of yellow, and beavertail cacti are erupting in bright splashes of hot pink. Looks like we all should be there. But while the desert may be one of the most dramatic springtime displays, wildflowers are popping up everywhere. There are bluebonnets and trout lilies, larkspurs and shooting stars. It's a great time to get out and observe. And if you snap photos of your finds, we have some tips on how you can ID those specimens and even share them with scientists. So give us a call. What have you spotted sprouting up in your area? Our number, 844-724-8255, or tweet us at SciFry. And if you need some inspiration, well, then check out the wildflowers our sci-fi producers have spotted at sciencefriday.com/bloom. It's interactive today. Tell us what you're seeing blooming in your area. Let me introduce my guests. Kenichi Weidu is co-director of iNaturalist.org in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira, great to be here.
Thanks. Andrea DeLongamaya is director of horticulture at the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I'm also glad to be here.
Well, happy to have you. Richard Minnick is author of California's Fading Wildflowers. He's also professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at the UC Riverside. Welcome to Science Friday.
Glad to be here.
Let me ask you, Andrea, what's blooming in Texas right now?
Gosh, the party is beginning. We have bluebonnets are pretty much full on, our Texas state flower. And then there's all kinds of other things. We have bitterweeds blooming and verbenas and coreopsis and a lot of Indian blanket. It looks really beautiful.
Has it been an early spring for these to bloom?
Yeah, it's been a little unusual in that regard, specifically with the bluebonnets. They were in our area probably 2 or 3 weeks earlier than normal or average. Normal, what does that mean? So average, yeah, we're a couple weeks early.
Richard, I know you've been out exploring some of these blooms in Southern California. Tell us what you've spotted so far.
Well, we've seen wonderful flowers across the Borrego Desert and Coachella Valley and many other areas. Lots of poppies. There's cryptantha, these are fiddlenecks, and wonderful flowers throughout the region.
Mm-hmm. Kenichi Weta, you have been down to the desert too. Pretty spectacular.
Totally spectacular. All the common things were sort of just explosive, so much more color and greenery than I've ever seen in the desert before. And lots of rare things that were coming up as well. For instance, one of my favorites, the ghost flower, is much, much more common this year than it has been in previous years. Usually it's kind of a semi-unusual flower, and this year it seemed to be at every place we stopped.
Well, now I know you have a tool that can be useful for people out spotting blooms, the app iNaturalist. You just download it to your phone. How does it work?
Sure. iNaturalist is an app and a website where you can share photos of any plant and animal, any wild plant and animal that you find. And you post it up to the internet, and other folks will help you figure out what it is and sort of talk about it and start a conversation about what it was you saw.
So it helps you get the name of things, and it helps everybody, you know, sort of crowdsource what they're seeing.
Sure. We crowdsource the identification process. So if you don't know what you saw, if you're out looking at wildflowers and you see something that totally blows your mind and you just want to put a name on it, you can post it to the website, and hopefully someone who knows that area will help you out with the name.
Are scientists actually using these photos that people submit?
Definitely. So a lot of our actual users are themselves scientists who are, you know, also naturalists and enjoy getting outside and looking at photos like everyone else. But a lot of scientists end up using the data that we share with several scientific data repositories. So if you're a scientist and you're studying desert blooms, you might be looking up occurrences of, you know, any time anyone has seen ghost flower. And these days, some of those records are going to come from iNaturalist and other citizen science data repositories.
Andrea, any suggestions for things people should be on the lookout for other parts of the country, like here in the Northeast. I know there's still snow on the ground in lots of parts of the Northeast, I can tell you, from my backyard.
Yeah, that's such a bizarre concept because we've been having summer-like temperatures here. We actually, one of the reasons for the early wildflower bloom is that we had a very warm end of our winter. We had a number of record-breaking warm days, like in the 80s, mid to even upper 80s. Predicted to be near 90 again this weekend, so it's hard to imagine that there's snow somewhere. But yeah, different parts of the country, you'll see different things, you know, trilliums and woodland areas. Of course, we have California covered, but there's stuff happening pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be early, you know, obviously it's still early for some areas if you're still under snow, but...
We saw before the snow that we had the crocuses were up, we had daffodils beginning to bloom, and then the snow was hit, and, you know, looking for that stuff.
Right, and the flowering trees. I know some areas were a little bit nervous about how they're going to fare through the cold weather.
Richard, your book is called California's Fading Wildflowers. That doesn't sound terribly optimistic here.
Well, optimistic and pessimistic, I suppose. But the whole state used to be covered with flowers from the coast to the mountains to the deserts. And now more and more we've had these flower fields invaded by European introduced species that are very, very aggressive and actually displace the flowers. The positive thing is the flowers can outdo them by having long seed life as opposed to the grasses, which have short seed life. And we're swaying back and forth from one to the other. So in wet years, it goes to the grasses, and in the dry years, we get more and more flowers, but the optimal situation right now is one wet year that follows a long drought, and we're in that right now.
Let's go to Oklahoma City. Stephanie has something to tell us. Hi, Stephanie. Stephanie, are you there? Stephanie.
We're big Science Friday fans. Yes, sir.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, we're just huge fans. We're just so excited to talk to you. We're also beekeepers.
Wow. So what? Have you seen the stuff going crazy in Oklahoma?
Heck yeah. Our spring's been coming earlier, you know, every year. We've seen a super bloom out here the year after we had a drought. There was a little bit of moisture in a hot spring, and everything went crazy, and every bug that was in diapause came out of the ground at once. And that was in late March, early April. And normally, stuff really doesn't get going here in central Oklahoma until mid-April.
Wow.
So this is weird. We've already had several days in the mid-90s.
No kidding.
Normally, you don't see that kind of temperature until you get down towards Houston.
Wow.
So,
well, I guess it's nice to see in a certain sense. You know?
Not really, no.
No.
It kind of freaks me out.
It's the new normal, Stephanie.
There is no normal. It goes. Our weather patterns here in central Oklahoma are already very extreme. It's making it more difficult for, I think, our forecasters to really get a handle on things. It changes our storm season.
Wow.
It changes our crop growing. It really messes with our honeybees really bad, because you can have 3 or 4 days where it's so hot the bees will start swarming, and then one super big cold snap, and that'll kill them off because there won't be enough to cluster around the queen.
I guess your senator is not noticing this climate change, though. So
no, Senator Snowball is not going to notice.
Okay. Thank you, Stephanie.
Okay.
Good luck with
this. You're welcome.
Enjoy. Let's go to Uniontown, PA, to Greg. Hi, Greg. What are you seeing out there?
How are you?
Yeah.
Good, good. Well, maybe not so good for the bees. I think my comments are pretty much going to mirror what your previous caller just said, that the roller coaster ride that we're on with ups and downs in temperature, especially in my region here in southwestern PA, have decimated my bees. I am also a beekeeper, and it seemed that when you start seeing honeybees emerging from the hive in January, that it's a little too soon.
Yeah.
And as Stephanie said, the bee ball inside breaks open, and they have to reform when it gets cold, and it wipes them out.
Yeah. Thanks for that call. I want to follow up, Richard. You touched on something before about the wetness. And is the reason all these blooms are happening in California this year simply because it's been so wet all year there?
Well, that's the first thing. It's necessary for a good bloom. But the second thing is that the annual weeds that have been suppressing our flowers have been knocked down greatly by the drought of the last 5 years in California. So finally, we come to a wet year without many weeds, and the flowers had their great moment, and they proliferated.
So you need the long drought, then, to have this bloom occur.
In this modern climate with the European annuals, absolutely. But in the old days, before these weeds were around, the flowers would come out great any wet year. But now, if we go to another wet year next year, don't expect the flowers because the annual grasses will take over again.
Well, give us a forecast. Do you think we're going to see another super bloom in Death Valley this year?
I think so. It's already good. I have my students who've been out there looking, and the deserts in general, it's a really good year so far. It's not like the great year in 2005, which made national news, but it's the best one since 2005.
And it's because of a continued wet weather or just a flash flood of some sort?
Well, the last year's was a flash flood, but this year is just a lot of good storms, and the deserts remain wet for months. So the flowers are really outstanding.
Well, I want to thank you, Richard, for taking time to be with us today. Richard Minnick is author of California's Fading Wildflowers and professor in the Department of Earth Science at UC Riverside. We're going to stay with our other guests. Kenichi Uedo is director of the iNaturalist, and Andrea DeLongamaya is director of horticulture at the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center at the University of Texas at Austin. We do want to get we do want you to participate and tell us what you're seeing. We want you to go out and look in your backyard now if you haven't, and go to our website and look at what stuff that we have on there, and then give us a call to tell us what kinds of stuff you're seeing in your neighborhood, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Tell us what kinds of blooms you're seeing. I see we have beekeepers out there talking about the bees. Lots of folks taking care of bees. It's been an unusual season for them, and we'll talk about a little bees later on in the show of unusual stuff that we're seeing with bees. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go away. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about springtime blooms and how to track them with your smartphone with my guest, Kenichi Ueda, co-director of iNaturalist.org in San Francisco, Andrea DeLongamaya, director of horticulture at the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center, University of Texas at Austin. And with all the flowers blooming now, you might wonder, well, how does it affect the bees? We have been getting phone calls in this afternoon about the bees, and this time I'm not talking about, in our case, about the honeybees. I'm talking about their lesser-known wild cousins, the solitary bees. Hollis Woodard is an assistant professor of entomology at UC Riverside in California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I know that you've been observing these buzzing desert homesteaders yourself.
Yep, we've been going out so far for the last few weeks, and we're seeing bees starting to come out and start visiting all these flowers.
What's the difference between the honeybee and the bee we're talking about here?
Well, so honeybees are not native to the U.S. They were brought here around the 1600s, we think. So they're non-native, but we have all these other bees, thousands of bee species that are native to the U.S., and they evolved here, and they visit all of these native flowering plants.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that one of the bees you study actually eats oil, a high-fat diet for bees?
Exactly. Yeah, this is a new bee for us, so this is our first year working in the system, but I have a researcher in my lab, Crystal Watrous, who's starting to investigate the system. So this is one group of bees in the deserts around here and elsewhere who have started to collect floral oils from a plant called Cremaria. And they collect these oils and they provision their nests with them, and the larvae feed off of the oils while they develop. And this is something that I think is super interesting, because when you think of bees, you think, okay, they eat pollen and nectar, but This is a whole other thing in their diet that comes from flowers that they're subsisting off of.
Are they also eating pollen for the protein too, or is this something else they add on?
That's a good point. So they are also, they do eat pollen and nectar. They're just eating these oils as well.
Seems like the desert is where all the wild, weird bees hang out. Would you agree with that?
It actually is. Yeah, it's a super, deserts in general are a big biodiversity hotspot for bees. And there are all kinds of bees that do weird things and eat weird things in the desert.
You know, California is finally escaping the years of drought. Any idea how a lot of these wild bees fare during the drought? Too early to tell?
Well, what a lot of folks might not know, as you mentioned, is that a lot of bees, most bees, are solitary and they nest in the ground. And what they do when the flowers bloom is they come out and they collect all these food resources from these flowering plants and they provision their nests with these foods. And then those foods that they've collected, they give rise to bees that will emerge typically the following year. And so a super bloom like we're having this year is having a huge impact on bee populations, but we won't really see that effect until next year. But there's some evidence that some bees can actually kind of hunker down and wait a few years before they emerge. So there are interesting time lag effects in terms of bees and how they're impacted by all these bloom periods.
It's amazing how you never run out of new things to discover about bees, do you?
Yep, it's really true. There's been such a big emphasis on honeybees and even bumblebees, the other group that I work on, but there are so many other species living around the world that have really different lifestyles than a honeybee does.
Kenichi, do you get insect sightings on the app too? Can people track a pollinator on there?
Absolutely. iNaturalist supports observations of any living thing. So if you see pollinators, if you see insects, you see hummingbirds, anything visiting the flowers are also fair game for observations.
All right, let's go to the phones because lots of people have now gone out and talked to their neighbors about what they're seeing. Let's go to Springfield, Missouri. Let's go to Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing, Ira?
Hi there. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, yeah. The best flower I've seen, and nobody likes it, but the dandelion is the one that's blooming crazy right now in Springfield. And some people don't like it, but I think it's a beautiful flower. It's also very nutritional. You know, you can make salad out of it. You can make wine out of it. And the bees really do like it. And I think that's part of the problem with the bees, especially the honeybees, is that people use so many insecticides to get rid of the dandelion, thinking of it as a weed. And I never looked at it as a weed. I look at it like a flower, a very, very pretty flower decorating your lawn.
Hmm. That's a good point. I mean, we'll get to Andre. Do you want to comment about
that? Yeah. Well, it's a good point. I mean, he makes a lot of good points. One of the things that we get a lot is, what is a weed? And it is really in the eye of the beholder. I mean, a weed, the way I like to think about it, is a plant that is where you don't want it to be. And so something that might be a perfectly wonderful plant in one situation can be a weed considered in another area. And with the dandelion, you know, it is a European species, so it's something that's been introduced into North America. And it's not surprising that the bees love it because it probably reminds them of home. So it is a little bit weedy in that sense that it's an introduced species and it is prolific, which a lot of people think of plants that are prolific as also being kind of weedy. But, you know.
I think prolific is a euphemism for a dandelion. Let's go to Carla in Ferdinand, Indiana. Hi, Carla.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you doing?
Great. Great.
What's on your mind?
Yeah, so you were talking about what's blooming in our area, and I live in southern Indiana and southwest Indiana, and we had sort of an early spring at first, and then we froze up for a little bit, didn't really get any snow. But so things seem to be pretty much on target now as far as blooming now. And we were in the woods the other day and just saw beautiful, beautiful patches of bloodroot. And I'm sure a couple of the folks that you've got there know a little bit about bloodroot. But it's just a beautiful little spring flower. The petals are about an inch and a half long, and they're only there for about 4 or 5 days. And then they all just drop off. And you wouldn't even know that it was a flower, and they're gorgeous.
Did you take any photos for us?
Well, I didn't. Some of the folks that I was with did take photos, but I'm not the photographer of the group. But yeah, they're beautiful, beautiful plants.
Well, Kenichi, they have to download the iNaturalist, right? So they can.
Yeah, they really should.
There you go. Yeah.
I concur. Bloodroot's a beautiful flower. I grew up in Connecticut, and I miss seeing it in the spring.
Well, you won't see it this spring, so I live in Connecticut. It's still pretty snowy.
A good one to look for when it's snowy out is a skunk cabbage in the Northeast. Many people probably don't think of that as a very beautiful flower, but I think it's really cool, and it can actually generate its own heat and melt the snow. So it's something
that
you can
right?
find even if there's still snow on the ground. Yep.
Wow.
Really cool flower.
Why do they call it skunk cabbage?
Well, Ira, if you tear it apart, you'll find out soon enough. It's got a pretty distinctive odor.
It's a rhetorical question.
Nature is just so amazing.
Andrea, there's been a bit of controversy over Cheerios distributing wildflower seed packets as a part of their campaign to save bees. What's the outcry all about here?
Well, I will say that it's nice that Cheerios is being sensitive about the issue, that they're trying to call attention to it. The Wildflower Center, we really want to promote native plants, and one of the issues that has come up is that in the seed mix, some of those species are not native to the United States. A lot of them are Eurasian and other places, and what's particularly concerning is if you have a seed mix that has species that are invasive, and this is something that Richard was mentioning earlier, when you have plants that really are not adapted to our area, they can contribute to loss of habitat for native vegetation, which then has a trickle-down effect for wildlife as well. So we really like to recommend people be very careful. It's a real responsibility to be smart consumers and try to use native plants as much as possible and really avoid the non-native things that could become invasive or that are proven to be invasive.
Mm-hmm. So they're really not, the outcry is a little overblown, do you think?
You mean, is it too much?
About Cheerios, over Cheerios distributing the seeds, or do you believe that they should not be doing that?
Well, ideally, they would be selecting things that are regionally adapted.
Yeah.
So if you could have a seed mix that had local native plants, that would be preferable to having things from Eurasia or other parts of the world.
Yeah, let's go to April in Houston. Hi, welcome to Science Friday, April.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had a question that's related to that. I drive home every day and I pass these depressing but lush-looking ditches, and I just imagine planting a ton of Texas wildflowers and being my own little mini Ladybird Johnson and doing that, and I think, gosh, am I going to mess something up, some kind of ecosystem inside of that ditch where I've only ever seen like a couple of turtles at best. And I just don't know, as far as being a responsible consumer, how I know what would not be
yeah.
harmful. Would it be a moot point? How can I help pollinators and plant things maybe in my own yard that'll actually help?
You want to know what is
hurt anything.
What you want to know what is safe to spread around in on the highway or your backyard or a vacant lot.
Yeah,
to make it bloom.
Just as a casual, non-scientist, like how can I help? Because I'm willing to do it. If I'm willing to spend $30 on some seeds and go and do that with my stepdaughter on the weekend, kind of thing.
Hollis, how can we help out this woman?
Yeah, I love hearing that question because. She's right. It's nuanced. You don't just want to put anything out. You want to make smart decisions. But you can go visit all the resources that are available for making those sorts of decisions. Like the Xerce Society has an excellent website, and the Ladybird Johnson Wildflower Center, they have a great database.
Thank you.
There are great books out there. So these are all things that you can turn to make those sorts of informed decisions. So in addition to spending, the $30 on the seed packet, if you spend a little bit of time to do your research on what should grow there, I think you'll be empowered to make those kinds of good decisions.
Good luck, April. Send us a photo when you plant something.
Thank you so much. I'll do that.
I might add one of the other resources besides the Wildflower Center website, which thank you for the promotion there. Also, most states have a local Native Plant Society chapters, and I found that they have been really helpful in helping to guide what is the best selection, but also a lot of them know where the resources are to get those plants. So sometimes they have seed swaps, and you might even be able to get some stuff for pretty cheap.
A lot of the universities have agriculture divisions too, like here in New York, Cornell has an outreach program, things like that. So you might do that. We do have a comment from the Cheerios people. They wrote us and said, the Honey Nut Cheerios wildflower packets contain the same variety of seeds that consumers will find in seed racks at major national home store chains throughout the U.S. So that is their response. Let's go, so many phone calls, so little time. Let's go to San Antone. Yeah. Let's see if we can get AG in San Antonio. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you. taking my call. I'm sorry, I'm on my way to work, but I just wanted to let you know that here in San Antonio, of course, we're in the southern edge of the hill country. And what I've seen is that as the city has expanded, wildflowers are getting, you know, covered over with asphalt and neighborhoods. So what my husband and I do is we take out a bucket to areas where we've seen the wildflowers when they're dying down. you know, so we find a safe place to collect the seed pods, which look, the bluebonnet seed pods look like little pea pods, tiny pea pods. And as they dry, they pop open and the seeds fly and they propagate that way. So we collect, we collect the seed pods. We put them on the back patio to dry. As they start popping, we collect them and then we take them out to areas that we like along the highways or around my neighborhood and just throw handfuls out wherever we would like to see them. And it has been working.
Wow. Wow. You're a Johnny Bluebonnet seed person.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the thing is that anybody can do this, and it only takes a few minutes. You just find a spot where there are where there's an abundance of flowers, and when you notice that the flowers are dying down, you see the little seed pods. You don't want to pick them too soon when they're green. So when they're looking brown, and you can see that some of them are opening and they're splitting. That's the time to collect them. Now, you've got to be careful because I've got bluebonnets in my backyard now where the seeds rolled off the patio.
All right. We have to go. We have to go, AG, but thanks for that tip. And there you go. That's how you can do it on your own. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I have to say to all my guests, when we, you know, we have certain subjects that just light up the switchboard here, and this subject has lit up. I mean, there's no room on a call board for more calls. You know, Kenichi, does this surprise you?
Not really. People really love wildflowers. Usually when you think of what people love to do in nature outside, people think of birds first, but we actually have kind of an equal number of bird and plant observations on iNaturalist. So we have lots of evidence that people really do love plants and getting outside and looking at wildflowers.
Any suggestions? Anybody want to chip in with any observing suggestions or anything to look for in the bees, Hollis? Any interesting phenomena?
Well, I'd just say that when it comes to desert bees, you know, they live in all sorts of different places, and some fly really early in the morning. And so if you go out really early, you might see some things that you wouldn't see otherwise. And if you look around on the ground, you might find some nesting in different places. So, yeah, there are all sorts of weird things you can see with the bees if you look a little bit more closely.
Andrea, is it possible for just a normal folk to actually find a new species?
That's a good question. I think every time I go out in the wild and I see something, I think it's a new species. That's when iNaturalist can be really handy, right? Oh, yeah. That's mm-hmm. Probably not very likely. Plants are pretty well documented. I mean, it certainly happens. A few years ago, we had maybe 10 or so years ago here in Texas, we had a native yucca that was discovered that had not been identified previously. But it's pretty unusual for that to happen.
Mm. Kenichi, you'd like to see that happen.
Absolutely. And it actually has happened on iNaturalist, not with flowers, but we had a species of poison dart frog that was observed on iNaturalist and turned it out to be a new species. So it can definitely happen, especially if you're looking at sort of relatively obscure groups of organisms, you know, things you find under rocks or weird worms, stuff like that.
So you'll take anything that we can take a picture of in nature.
We're not so into like dogs and cats, but any wild animal or plant is totally cool.
All right, that's where we're going to end it. It's a good way to end it. Kenichi Ueda is co-director of iNaturalist.org in San Francisco. Andrea DeLong Amaya, director of horticulture at the Lederberg Johnson Wildflower Center at the University of Texas at Austin. And Hollis Woodard is assistant professor of entomology at UC Riverside. And thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy spring, everybody.
Happy spring. And you can still send your photos. Our website at sciencefriday.com has all kinds of links up there for all the flowers we're talking about. We're going to take a break, and mathematician Eugenia Cheng is going to guide us through the world of infinity. I mean, this is a great new book that she has written called Beyond Infinity, and she's great at talking about it and all the math that leads up to it. It's not the thing, your hair won't hurt talking about this, but you will discover amazing little things that we didn't know about infinity. And you can call us 844-724-8255 about math and infinity, which we'll talk about right after the break. So stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, as a kid, you talk about numbers. Isn't one of the first numbers you like to talk about as a kid, make fun of it, is infinity, you know? Typical six-year-old conversation. Here it goes. I have 10 cookies. I have 100 cookies. Well, I have infinity plus one cookies, right? You've been through that conversation. You hate it when that kid comes up. The entire playground goes silent. Well, kids might use infinity to mean really big, beyond our imaginations. But what does infinity really mean? Is it an actual number? Is it just a boundary? Does infinity plus one actually exist? And what can baby carrots tell us about this complex concept? My next guest talks about all of this stuff in her new book and is here to help us wrap our brain around this big idea. Eugenia Cheng is a mathematician and scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, and her new book is called Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, it's great. This is such a great book and so easy to read. It's filled with...
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad you think
well,
so.
Well, it's filled with such vernacular, like little phrases, like when you go through a problem, you say, wait for it, you're going to come up with the answer. It's great. Why tackle infinity now?
Well, as you say, it's something that even little kids love to think about and play around with in their heads. But what does it actually mean? And it's amazing because it took mathematicians thousands of years to figure out how to think about it in such a way that it would make sense logically and not just in our imaginations.
Why do we even need the concept of infinity?
Well, what does need really mean, you know? There's a difference between want and need that my little nephew has been studying in school. And the thing is that math, some people think that math is all about getting the right answers. And one of the big messages that I want to get across is that actually it's more than that. It's not always just about getting the right answers, but it's about asking the right questions and exploring possible answers and seeing what possible answers are available in different types of situations. And infinity doesn't have just one answer. It doesn't just have one way of thinking about it. There are so many fascinatingly different ways of thinking about it that produce different weird scenarios.
Yeah.
Like, can you eat infinite cookies? Do you ever actually travel anywhere? What is time? And are there baby carrots?
Let's start backwards here. What do you mean, are there baby carrots? How does that fit in?
Well, this is a real and very important argument I once had with a mathematician, of course, about whether baby carrots really exist or whether they're just cut, you know, like those baby cut carrots that you can get that are unnervingly cylindrical and don't look like they really grew like that. But when I was little, we grew carrots in the garden, so I knew perfectly well that if we pulled them out of the ground before they were big, then, well, they would be small. And this is actually something to do with a theorem in mathematics called the intermediate value theorem, which is something that students usually only study when they get to some quite high level of calculus. But it comes from understanding not just infinitely big things, but infinitely small things. And the infinitely big and the infinitely small are, well, infinitely related.
Hmm. And now, getting back to the kids' conversation, the kid talks about infinity plus one, as if infinity is a number. And you
yes.
talk about how it can't be a number in your book, and with very easy, simple explanations about zero.
Right. It depends what you mean by number. So if you're going to say infinity is or isn't a number, then first of all, you have to say, what are numbers? And so I start by talking about the fact that numbers are things we can add up and multiply and subtract. And if you just take those basic operations and you pretend that infinity is a number for a second, then you get to deduce logically that everything equals zero, which it's not that great. If everything equaled zero, well, there wouldn't really be anything, would there?
No. I want to quote you from a book, some really interesting things that you say throughout. Let me read one. One of the things that is tantalizing about infinity is that it's so easy to stumble upon the idea, so easy to stumble upon the strange, apparently magical behavior that surrounds it, yet so difficult to work out what on earth is really going on.
That's right. And I like to think of the exploration of mathematics as being just like wandering around a weird jungle or a new landscape where you can see things and you can feel things about them, but you don't really know what they are. And so if you find yourself in that weird, mysterious world, well, if I find myself there, I really want to know what's going on. I'm curious about it. And that's what drives my love of mathematics. I'm a bit like that 2-year-old child who keeps saying, why? And then you answer. And then you go, why? And why? And why? So when you're faced with the fact that infinity causes strange things to happen, you can either run away. And unfortunately, that's what too many people do with mathematics. And I have sympathy for that because it can be a little unnerving. Or you can delve into it and try and figure out what's going on.
Well, we're
going
to delve into it a little bit more with some calls from listeners because they want to talk about infinity. Peter in Iowa City. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate everything you guys do.
Thank you.
And here's my favorite question about infinity. How many different infinities are there? And then which one is it?
Okay, Peter, we'll try to answer that. Eugenia, what do you think?
There are infinitely many infinities.
There you have it.
As it turns out, there's a hierarchy of infinities because as soon as you have one infinity, then you can create a bigger one by saying 2 to the power of infinity. And then you can say 2 to the power of that. And then you can say 2 to the power of that. And that never stops. And so if you're having an argument with a child and they're saying, well, I'm right times infinity, then you can say, well, I'm right times 2 to the power of infinity. But unfortunately, they can then say, well, I'm right times 2 to the power of 2 to the power of infinity. And then you'll never really get anywhere. So perhaps we shouldn't have arguments like that.
Well, you know, you're saying this, it just reminded me, you know, physicists use mathematics to prove all kinds of stuff. And one of the things they talk about is the infinite number of universes that might be. The multiverses? Is this an idea they got from math about infinities?
I wouldn't like to speak for physicists, but physics does often get a lot of ideas from mathematics. And I like to think that math is there to serve everyone else and to try and clarify the way that we can think about the world around us. The great thing about mathematics is that we can think about possible worlds that only exist in our imagination. But just like fiction helps us understand real life, those fictional worlds help us understand real life as well. But we're not constrained by reality in the way that physicists are trying to understand actual reality. I get to wander around in the depths of my imagination all the time. And then some of it ends up helping physicists understand the real world.
But if you're really making up stuff in mathematics, which is what I hear you saying, and tell me if I'm wrong, you talk about your book about mathematical rigor in that this stuff has to really work out.
Yes, we do make stuff up, but there are a few rules and guidelines that we have to stick to. And that is that we have to use the rules of logic. And that's what mathematics is all about. Different subjects and disciplines get at information by different methods. And so science uses evidence and mathematics uses logic. So we can make anything up that we want as long as it obeys the rules of logic. And if you have a contradiction in what you try to make up, then the whole world implodes. But
oh well,
it was only an imaginary world. So you can just try again and do a different one.
Gosh, you can't be wrong. Does that mean you can't be wrong?
When I'm teaching my art students, I have discovered that my art students at the School of the Art Institute have often been put off math in the past by the fact that they could be wrong. And no one really likes being wrong, I don't think. So what I say to them, I don't really say that they're wrong. I just say that they caused a contradiction and their whole world imploded.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. You know, why is a mathematician in residence, scientist in residence at the School of Art Institute in Chicago?
Isn't it fantastic? It's my dream job, actually, because the School of the Art Institute has an amazing vision that there shouldn't really be boundaries between subjects. And I agree with that. And so we're trying to erase the boundary between art and science and show that science and scientific thinking and mathematical thinking is relevant to everybody. And there isn't really a cutoff between there and art and artistic practice. And in fact, since I've been there, amazingly, I've started making mathematical art. I was commissioned by the new hotel EMC2, so I have become an artist making mathematical art installations to show also that my mathematics is also a bit like art.
You're a musician, too, and we've heard over the years that music and math go together, and you seem to prove that point.
Let's be careful here, because that's a sample size of one, so we shouldn't say
it's
that
more than
actually
one.
Proves the
I
point.
I can find 10 people.
So it's an interesting question, and I think about it a lot because people ask me, and I think that for me, because math isn't just about numbers, the relationship between math and music is about something deeper than that. It's about structures. And there's so much interesting structure in the way that music is built up. And mathematics, for me, really looks at the way things work and the way things are built up, the way that ideas fit together. Just like you build a building by fitting maybe bricks and mortar together, probably not so much bricks anymore, but steel pieces. You fit pieces together and that makes a physical structure. In mathematics, we fit ideas together and we make an abstract structure. And the aim of my work in the field called category theory is to look at what it is that holds those ideas together and what it is that might make ideas collapse and fall down.
Now you talk about math and ideas. No one in school is taught that way that I know of. You taught the count and whatever, and never to really appreciate math. Do you think we need to have more math art classes or to teach kids the beauty behind the math?
I do think we need to teach kids the beauty, the fun, and the fascination behind the math. And there are some really great math teachers out there, and I've met them, and I talk to them, and they're trying really hard. Unfortunately, they're often constrained by the tests and the standards that they're required to meet, and the tests are often the exact opposite of beauty. They're finding the answers, the formulae, doing the things over and over again to try and jump past an arbitrary hurdle. Whereas I've discovered by teaching art students that if I show students what fascinates me and what's beautiful, and to show that it's an exploration of possibilities rather than a journey with just one specific aim in mind, then they're much more interested by it and they're drawn into it, especially art students who are fundamentally creative people. They think visually. They're not interested in just memorizing formulae and solving specific problems. They're interested in uncovering ideas, and that's what math is about, really. So I think that we should be telling that, teaching that to students of all ages at school.
Talking with Eugenia Cheng, author of Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics, a really great book to have a read, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And we don't usually get a full board of folks who want to talk about math, but we have maxed out our math here.
That's great.
let's go to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I lost his name or her name. Hi, Cedar Rapids. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, this is Douglas.
Thank you.
And I had a quick question. I was hoping you could maybe help me solve a longstanding dispute I had with my mother. We were born on the same day, 24 years apart. And when I was taking calculus in high school, I told her that eventually, if we both lived to infinity, that we would be the same age. And she vehemently disagreed with me. And so I was just hoping maybe I could get some clarity in this.
That's a great question. And I love the if at the beginning of that, because if you could both live to infinity, well, it depends how we take logic, because you're not both going to live to infinity. Well, you're probably not both going to live to infinity. And so if you did, then logically kind of anything would be true. So you would both be the same age, and you would also both not be the same age, and you'd also both be elephants. But I think if we take it a little bit more literally than that, then I think you would both be infinity years old if you both lived to infinity. And because, now here's the thing, because the difference in your age stages happened at the beginning and not at the end, I think it would be the same. Whereas infinity plus one, now that could be really something different. And I think that we learnt this from Shakespeare, because in The Taming of the Shrew, he talks about forever and a day. So I think he knew that forever and a day is longer than forever. Otherwise, he'd have just said forever.
Is infinity a constant?
Is infinity a constant? Well, it depends what kind of infinity you're talking about. I think that we have pinned down infinity to be various different possible types of number. It can be thought of as an ordinal number, which means if you lined lots of people up in a queue, how long is that queue? It's that sort of idea. It's also a cardinal number, where it's just the size of a certain number of things. So if you think about the number 10, what is the number 10? Well, one way we tell children is that it's the number of fingers that you have. And so infinity is then, the first infinity is the number of whole numbers that there are. And that is constant, because I'm pretty sure we're not going to spontaneously discover a new whole number that we didn't know about. So I would say that yes, infinity is constant.
Well, my last question is about pi. Pi, it's a real number, but it can go on infinitely long, right?
Yes, that is to say that the decimal expansion of it goes on forever and doesn't repeat itself, because it's an irrational number. And this is related to infinitely small things, because what mathematicians realized really 2000 years ago is that if you just look at the fractions, things like 2 over 3, 3 over 5, 6 over 7, things like that, they're very, very close together, but not totally close together. There are always teeny weeny little gaps in between them. And so to fill in those gaps, if we want to fill in those gaps, then we need the irrational numbers, that is the decimal numbers that go on forever. And if we don't have those gaps, well, then every line we draw would have, I mean, if we don't fill in those gaps, then every line we draw will have tiny gaps in it, which is a bit odd. Then when we walk from A to B, we might skip some places along the way, which is also quite odd. And it also means that baby carrots might not exist.
Wow. And a rational way to think about the irrational. And only as Eugenia Cheng can do it. She's author of the new book, Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics. She's a mathematician and scientist in residence of all places, the School of Art Institute of Chicago. And you can read an excerpt from this terrific, this really great book for the weekend, sciencefriday.com/infinity. We have an excerpt. Thank you, Dr. Cheng, for taking time to be with us today. A great book.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have you back. That's about all the time we have for today. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. You can leave us comments about this or anything else you'd like to talk to us about on our website at sciencefriday.com. And Science Friday is here all days of the week, up on Facebook and Twitter and everywhere else you'd like to find us in our podcast. Have a great weekend, thinking about infinity, maybe. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.